Okay, so kind of quick recap, if you like. So transmedia has been understood as something that's quite comparatively new. Next few lectures, we're going to sort of examine the extent to which that maybe isn't true. But in terms of general sort of introductions, somehow transmedia is dependent on a very contemporary media landscape. So very specifically, it's to do with industries converging. Giant multinational corporations that have multiple different outlets and platforms and companies at their disposal, which means that these owners can spread their stories across very, very easily without having to negotiate anything or license anything. And perhaps even more so than that, the rise of digital media. Digital media is all about connectivity and hybridity and connections and enabling us to talk to people on the other side of the world with the spread with the click of a button. So this, therefore, by extension, kind of explains why films now also extend across platforms. What I would say is that it's not necessarily dependent on that, but it certainly makes it easier to tell a story across platform if we are talking about this very contemporary, converged, digital context. So to move this on, I thought I'd kind of just move on to think about characteristics. So very basic, fundamental characteristics of what transmedia stories look like, what they do. Now, tomorrow's I'm going to sort of dig back into this and offer some more kind of expansive characteristics, some kind of more slightly more useful, I think, slightly more nuanced ideas. But for the purposes today, again, general sort of introduction. So what have people said in terms of what transmedia stories look like? Elizabeth Evans, her book was kind of 2011, she said, well, there's three general characteristics, very, very basic ideas of what transmedia stories look like, okay? And it's all about this idea of coherence. Now, she doesn't define what coherence actually means. I think it's a little bit problematic, but this idea that somehow things fit together, okay? It's kind of like, think about it, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. Okay, all the pieces in a jigsaw are coherent. If they weren't, they wouldn't be part of the same jigsaw puzzle. The idea is all of them have to somehow fit together. So you have all of these different pieces. They're all separate. So a film might be separate, the game might be separate, the comic book might be separate. But they also connect in a very strategic, systematic way. And when they're all connected, they make something that's bigger than the sum of the parts. In this case, a story world. So all the media somehow fits together, as we've seen. And maybe we can think of this as coherence, okay? And the first idea is this idea of narrative coherence. It's fairly sort of straightforward. Narrative coherence. So it's not just you tell a story in a film, and then you tell another story in a game, and then you tell another story in a comic book. The idea is that this is all one story. It's all part of exactly the same storyline that just happens to have been broken up as if it was a jigsaw puzzle. Okay? So that means that whoever makes all of this has to very systematically think about what is the grand story being told. They can't just write a script for a film anymore and then pass it over to some video game developers. They have to think, well, okay, what's the big story that's being told here? And how can I think of my film as one piece of that jigsaw puzzle, rather than as the whole story with its own beginning, middle, and end, and then that's the whole end of the story? This is somehow part of something else. It has to cohere into something else. And obviously that raises questions industry-based. It means that, you know, filmmakers suddenly, I think, their job is harder than it's ever been, because they now have to think, okay, I've got this great script, I've managed to get it to Warner Brothers, they're finally going to finance it, it's finally going to happen, but in order to make the film happen, there has to be a game, and the story of the game has to feed into the story of the film. So now I've got to rework my script in order to make that work. Lots of sort of coordination problems, all right? So The Matrix, again, she points to exactly the same example. Well, she says there is a clear narrative coherence, and we saw this in the making of video. There was clearly someone had thought through how this character weaves in, at what point that character is going to disappear from the film but come into the film. So there's a very nice example where in The Matrix Reloaded, if you've seen it, there's a character called Niobe, who I can't remember who plays it, Will Smith's wife, I can't remember her name. She just appears on a freeway. There's a big kind of giant action sequence is going on, and she just appears in a car, and she saves Morpheus. He's falling off a lorry, and she kind of catches him. And when you watch the film, you think, well, how did she know that they were on the freeway? How could she possibly have known they would be there at that time, at that moment, and she needed to be there to catch him in exactly the way that she did? And in the film, it's never explained. It almost comes across as a plot hole, in a way. But then it's not a plot hole, because then when you watch the film, which was released, as we saw, at exactly the same time, features exactly the same characters with these intersecting storylines, you play as that character. So you don't play as the character from the film, you play as this separate character who also appears in the film. And as you play out that character, you embark on a mission in the game where you actually learn how she knew to be on that freeway at exactly the same point, at exactly that time. And the whole point of the mission in the game is to save Morpheus before he falls off the lorry. So if you watch the film and then play the game, suddenly that point in the film makes much more sense. It's not a plot hole because you followed it across media, okay? And for that to happen, there has to be very, very careful, systematic narrative coherence. You can't just tell a different story and hope that audiences are somehow going to find that story interesting. There has to be some connection, Jenkins or Evans would say, in order to make it useful as a piece of storytelling, or make it meaningful as a piece of storytelling. Still talking about coherence, she also offers this idea of authorial coherence. This is something I'm going to pick up on a lot tomorrow, actually. This is really, really important. This idea that this can't happen if it's not the same people making it, okay? You might disagree with that, and actually I'd offer you to completely disagree with some of these ideas. But Evans would say, well, the reason why that narrative coherence works is precisely because it's the same writers and directors making the game as made the film. So they knew who all the characters were, and they knew what the larger story was, and they knew the different threads of the plot. And that meant that they could say, okay, we're going to put that in the film, that in the game, they're going to intersect at this particular moment, and it's going to make complete sense to people who watch the film and watch the game. If the film had been the Wachowski brothers, and the game had been some gamer sitting in some office in LA who had no idea what was going on in the film, the argument would be that wouldn't really work, because how could they know what the story of the film was going to be? There would have to be at least some coordination, some discussion, the Wachowski brothers telling these gamers what was going to happen. So having a kind of authorial coherence, the same people, whether it's the writer or director, or something else that Evans suggests is, well, actually, maybe the author can be a company, maybe it can be an institution. So something like the BBC, for example, she says is the author of Doctor Who. The writers might change episode to episodes, the directors might change episode to episodes, the people who make the games are different writers again, but there is somebody at the top, maybe a pool of people at the top of the BBC, and they know what these grand narratives are, they know what these big stories are, therefore they can feed that information down to all the people underneath them and make sure it remains coherent. If that wasn't the case, Would the stories become muddled? Probably. And then the last one she talks about, this is the kind of another sort of textual point, is this idea of temporal coherence. So here she's kind of talking about, well, it's two things actually. First of all, it's the idea that in terms of the storytelling, there is a temporal order to everything, okay? Because it's all one story, it means that the film has to take place here and the game has to take place there, because the stories are connecting. If they were told in a different order, it kind of wouldn't make sense, right? So it's the idea on a storytelling level, everything happens in a very particular order, like storytelling itself, beginning to middle to end. But also what she means is the idea that in terms of when these things are released as products, the distributors suddenly have a really, really important role to play, because it means they have to release these as products in a very, very particular order. They have to know that it makes sense that the game comes a month after the film and not a month before the film. They have to know that the comic book has a separate subplot with a character that actually spoils what might happen in the film. So you can't release that before the film. So it's this sense that, okay, this one has to come out in January, this one has to come out in February, this one maybe can come out at Christmas, and you can't mess around with that particular schedule, because if you do, the storytelling suddenly doesn't make any sense. So you can see what I mean. It suddenly makes things very difficult. Filmmakers have a very complicated role to play. Studios have a very complicated role. Writers, distributors also have a very, very complicated role to play. They have to think about their own little products as pieces of a much larger puzzle, and they kind of have to be very happy to play along with these bigger ideas, because if you don't, this transmedia element falls apart, and it's all this idea of coherence. So it's incredibly difficult, right? So then you think, well, why do it? Why bother going to so much trouble to coordinate all of this? You know, making a film and another film, but making a comic book and making a game and coordinating with all of the different writers and the producers and the distributors and making it all work as some very clever puzzle-like storytelling experience. Well, there's lots of reasons. And actually, these reasons, as you see, multiply. When we start thinking about it historically and thinking about it in global context and different cultures, actually you realise the reason why transmedia exists is many more reasons than you could possibly think. But in terms of a Hollywood context, this is what I mean here, okay? As we've seen, it's about engaging wider audiences, okay? They may well make a film like Avatar because they think it's going to appeal to a global audience. In fact, I would bet money that that's the reason when, you know, someone was sitting in the boardroom and Avatar was being pitched, you can hear the studio execs thinking, well, that's going to appeal to that audience, and this is going to look fantastic in whatever country, and all these audiences are going to love it. It's got love stories, and it's beautiful, and it's aesthetically amazing. But it's still an audience. It's still a narrow audience that we're talking about with a film or with a TV show. So transmedia enables you to break these borders away and think, actually, let's not think about demographics anymore. Let's not think about we're going to appeal to this age group, or this is going to appeal to men, or this is going to appeal to women. We can just create Avatar and we can have different pieces of it. And like we saw with the game, maybe it's going to appeal to a different audience in a different way, simply because it's on a different platform. Avatar on film doesn't necessarily appeal to that many Americans. Avatar on a game does. And obviously the obvious implication to this is money, okay? Hollywood loves transmedia because if it's done well, it multiplies profits. It means that you have and this was in the first video as well, it multiplies revenue streams. It means that suddenly Avatar is this, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this. All of them have audiences, maybe the same audience, maybe a different audience. And all of them are paying for Avatar, or paying for The Matrix, or paying for Doctor Who. So it's keeping the revenue streams high. Even when the film's died in the cinema and nobody's gone to see it, there's all these other alternative revenue streams. So in that sense, it's kind of a way to reduce risk, you might argue. You could flip it around and say, well, maybe it's not because it's so expensive. But if it's done well, it can be a way to reduce risk. And in terms of audiences, this is something we've not really looked at today, but we will do, is how incredibly active it makes the audience. And it's this idea of giving the audience more to do, right? So Traditional film studies would say, well, if you kind of go back in time, there's this idea of a passive audience. There's this idea that, you know, we used to go to the cinema and we would watch a film and we just sit there and we just take it all in, and we're very passive in terms of that consumption process. The idea behind transmedia is actually kind of abolishes that a little bit. Yes, we're going to the cinema and we're watching the film, but then we also hunt down other pieces of the story. So we have to go online and find out when the video game's out. And then the video game is innately interactive. So we can play as particular characters and we can do things as an audience that makes us quite active. We can then go and find out when the DVD for the animation thing is going to be released. And there might be clues in the particular story that give us insights into the film, which means we want to then watch the film again. So we go and buy the DVD, for example. We can go online and read, we can post blogs, and we can write about the film, and we can engage in all these kind of really interesting creative ways. It gives us something to do, right? And if you are, Jenkins would say, if you're really engaged and you follow all of the story and you learn about all of these particular pieces of information, it's rewarding. Because then you can kind of brag to your friends. You can say, well, I understand The Matrix better than you, because you think that's a plot hole at that moment when he falls off the lorry. But actually, I know why she was on that freeway at exactly that particular point, because I played the game. Okay, so it makes, there's a sense, it's like a loyalty thing. It's a reward scheme that's going on. Okay, so in terms of kind of other sort of codes or conventions or characteristics, again, I'm going to delve into this much more tomorrow. But what I thought I'd point to is a set of kind of ideas, if you like, that I don't think anybody has ever said this is what underpins transmedia storytelling. Simply because it's a really old example, and it predates Elizabeth Evans, and it predates Henry Jenkins, and it predates all these discussions of convergence. But it was always there, okay? And this is somebody called Marcia Kinder, who technically is the first academic to use the word transmedia. She doesn't get credited for it very often, but she is. And she talked about this idea of transmedia intertextuality. So she didn't talk about storytelling yet, but she used the word transmedia. And it was in a book from 1991 with a fantastic title. And she was talking about children's media. Things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was an example. And Mario, this kind of stuff. And she was looking at actually how, in terms of how it was produced, this was moving across platforms. And in terms of how children engage with stories, they don't stay in a single media platform. And they never have done. Children are fantastic at understanding different things. You know, you can show a two-year-old an iPad and they understand what's going on, and they can swipe across and they can move to the next game. For some reason, kids just understand this concept of moving across media in a way that when you grow up, you suddenly have to start thinking about it in a different way. This is what she was arguing. She says, well, children always move across platforms. So she called it transmedia back in the 90s. And she offered these three sort of principles, if you like. And it's one kind of leads to the other. So she said, if you look at a lot of children's media, what's really going on here is intertextuality. So this is a sort of film studies term. And if you're not aware, so intertextuality is the idea of a film potentially referring to another film, or a story referring to another story. So Quentin Tarantino, for example, is often said to be an intertextual filmmaker, because all of his films make reference to other types of films, and he blurs different genres together, and he talks about characters from other films. So she said, if you look at kids' TV or kids' films or kids' media, they're always intertextual. They're always talking about something else or other stories or other forms of children's media. And what this means is it's kind of a network of intertextuality, one text referring to another. And actually that, I think, essentially underpins the storytelling aspect of everything we've just been looking at. They are all intertextual. The Matrix as a transmedia story has to be intertextual. The game refers explicitly to the film. The characters in the film talk about things that happen in the game. The comic has events, story plot events, that acknowledge things that have happened in one of the other films. That's intertextuality. It's media referring to other media. If it doesn't do that, you could argue, well, would it still be transmedia? Probably not. In order for this to work, in order for it to be connected, different stories in different platforms have to acknowledge what's going on in each of them. They have to be aware of what's going on. Things like Marvel is a good example. The Marvel films, this is transmedia, right? The different characters, you can know what's going on in each of those films. So Thor, even if it's a film about Thor, knows what happened in Captain America 2. It's that sort of intertextuality that we're talking about. So if that's all about storytelling, she says, well, kind of the next thing that kind of leads to is outside of the text. It's more about the packaging or how it's presented as a product. Something what I've kind of put in brackets is branding, because it's something I'm going to talk about. But she calls it collectability. The idea that actually, in this case, children's media, if they all refer to one another and different stories and different films refer to other films, that means that either as a child or as a parent of that child, you feel compelled to collect all of them. You then want to find out the next thing. You buy the next product. You buy the next piece of story. Which is also very much this idea of making audiences active, isn't it? You know, giving them something to do, rewarding them, encouraging them to hunt down new pieces of media. And then the last thing, she said, if you have an intertextual story, it encourages this idea of collectability. And what that ultimately leads to is, she calls it, accelerates the growth curve of a commercial system. In other words, it makes more money. It encourages people to spend more and more, to buy more and more, to consume more and more. I would call that cross-promotion, because it's something, again, I'm going to pick up on in later lectures. The idea that actually one product is advertising something else. So even if you're watching a film, you're watching the Matrix film, actually what's going on? It's advertising the game. Right? And the game is advertising the film, and the film is advertising the comic book. It is storytelling, but it's also cross-promotion. So just to give you a couple of examples, so Heroes is kind of often talked about as a really interesting transmedia story. Piece of television, highly intertextual. So you have the television episodes, which are great, but you also have the comic books, and they all refer to one another on a very deliberate textual level, okay? So the comic book actually features within the context of the story. So, do you see what I mean? So the comic book is not just a product that we buy as an audience. The characters in the TV show are aware of this comic book. It exists in their own world, okay? So the character picks up the comic book that we can then actually buy. So that's intertextual. It's the TV show on screen making direct intertextual reference to a comic book, okay? Acknowledging it within the same time frame, within the same narrative, within the same fictional world. Explicit intertextuality. And if you do that, it means the storytelling can then move across, right? So what you see there can then suddenly move across over here. Harry Potter, so this would be a kind of collector's branding idea. It's not just about the story and the intertextuality, it's how it's packaged, okay? The fact that all of these things look the same as products is very, very important. They all have the same logo. They all have the same typeface. They even use exactly the same colour schemes. They have the same actor, the same character, the same kind of tone. It's got nothing to do with the story or what's going on in it, but it means as an audience, when you see all of these, you just know that they belong together. You don't have to question it. You don't think, well, is this part of that? Do I need that in order to understand this? Is this part of the same storytelling experience? You don't have to buy it in order to find out whether this is an intertextual story. The fact that they look the same branding design, same logo, same colours, same visuals, same characters, and so on and so forth, you just know. You know they are all part of exactly the same storytelling experience. And this makes more money. It means that things are constantly being cross-promoted. So an implication of this, and this is something, again, I'm going to pick up on, is actually, is this just advertising? Is this basically glorified advertising? Is it advertising that is being presented as storytelling in order to make it not seem like advertising? All right? Just to give you a quick example. So The Dark Knight Rises, big Batman blockbuster, obviously it's a film. There was a advertising campaign that was tied in to the film, and they made games and they made websites that was paid for as advertising, and it was designed as promotion for the film. But in terms of what they did, in terms of what they made, I think this is also transmedia storytelling. So what do you think?
In 2012, Mountain Dew became the global partner of an iconic franchise in the cinema world, The Dark Knight Rises. It was a great peg for youngsters who look forward to seeing this film soon. Our targets were to leverage this partnership to boost sales in the summer season and grow brand loyalty, to get the buzz going with social media and in-store support. Our ambition was to go beyond boring co-branding. We created a campaign with a collect and get promo and online games as the core excitement. Go inside Gotham City. Players were invited to experience the Dark Knight's world through the eyes of Jim Gordon's assistant and to win a super prize of $1,000. They were asked to investigate the chain of crimes by collecting evidence, inviting friends to help, asking witnesses, and solving different puzzles. The player's goal was to call the Dark Knight to save Gotham City. Every week, the three fastest and smartest won $1,000 each. The buzz hit the web like a tidal wave. We succeeded in engaging almost every user that came to see the game and grew the daily active audience to 10,000 users on average. More than half of the users were invited to play the game by their friends, and they spent almost 12 minutes in the game on average, which is close to the top 5 games in social network Kandakye. For those who didn't want to play the game, we offered simple collect-and-get mechanics with attractive prizes. As a result, during the game period, we doubled the audience on the promo website and got a 30% codes registration increase. In fact, the game was such a success that Mountain Dew in Egypt and Romania requested Facebook adaptations for their local fans. Go inside Gotham City.
Okay, so as daft as that voiceover is, quite interesting. Okay, so it's, you know, clearly the people who made this, it's not Christopher Nolan that did that. I think that's very, very clear. This isn't Christopher Nolan. This isn't the story of the film. It's not even Warner Brothers in this case. It's some external company that Warner Brothers are working with that have been paid to think, okay, we've put $250 million into this Batman film. We're a bit worried about the audience size, so can you try and generate some buzz? Can you make it exciting? Can you get people talking about it on social media? Do whatever you like. This is advertising. It is explicitly a form of marketing. But in terms of what they did, it's very, I think, difficult to draw the line between that and what Henry Jenkins is talking about in the Matrix example and the Avatar example. You can literally, as it says, go inside Gotham City. So this is the idea of a story world, just like Evans calls it, or Jenkins calls it. Creating a bigger world for your story to sit in, which means there's other things going on in this particular world, and the different stories can be told with different characters, and you can engage different audiences in different ways. It's interactive in the way that all these people have been talking about. It makes people hunt down parts of the story. It makes them loyal. It gives them something to do. In this case, play a particular game. There was things, I mean, they didn't really kind of go into it, but there were things like this. So there were newspapers that had been made, so fake newspapers that existed in the world of the Batman film. So Gotham City, so the Gotham City Chronicle. And these people, these marketing guys, wrote a newspaper as if it was a real thing. And they learn about types of stories. So some of them were kind of more jokey, like Batkid, for example. But there was others that explicitly existed within the context of the film. So they learned about who the characters were, and they kind of told you little stories and little insights into the different characters, things that don't happen in the film. So you learn about the backstory and the history and things that's been going on in Gotham City before you actually get to The Dark Knight Rises. That's transmedia storytelling. That is you as an audience moving across platforms, in this case to a website or to a game, and you are learning about the story and the world and the characters of, in this case, a film. You are engaged, you are finding out new pieces of information, and that story is unfolding across multiple media platforms. So it is a question. I don't think there's an answer to this, but it is something I'm going to pick up on quite a lot. Is this storytelling, or is this marketing? Or is it marketing disguised as storytelling, or storytelling disguised as marketing? And indeed, what's the difference between transmedia storytelling and advertising? Is there actually a difference? And this sort of kind of moves on to some kind of danger. So, if you look at what academics say about transmedia, they love it. They think it's the best thing that's happened in the last 20 or 30 years. They think that stories are richer. They think that they engage audiences in more ways. They think it makes more money for audiences. Nobody can possibly lose from doing this. Even something as silly as a sort of game like that kind of example. What happened? Everyone starts talking about The Dark Knight Rises on social media. And Warner Brothers didn't do that. It wasn't the film that generated that buzz. It was this transmedia campaign. So what could possibly not be great? I think there's a few things, okay? The first is this sort of audience fatigue, okay? So when, if you think about that first industry video where they're saying, well, it engages the audience and it keeps them engaged and it makes them loyal, what they don't acknowledge is the amount of time that it takes to consume all of this. If all of a sudden we're not just watching films, but we're watching films that turn into websites, that turn into games, that turn into comics, and they all feed into one another in a really interesting, creative way, and we have to consume them all in order to make sense of that story, that takes time. I don't know about you, I haven't got enough time to do that. I find it difficult to watch a film these days, let alone do all of this other stuff, okay? So there's an element of time, but also, do we want to do that as an audience? Do we, we might enjoy a film for 2 hours, but do we really want to have to keep consuming more and more and more in order to actually find out what's going on in the first place? So there's a risk in terms of actually not engaging the audience, but making them disengaged, potentially. I think one of the things that could happen, and The Matrix is a really good example of this sort of incoherent narrative. So if you think about it, if a film is just part of a puzzle that connects to a game, and in order to understand the film, you have to go over there and play the game, that means that the film by itself could be seen as quite incoherent. So if you go and read, for example, some of the reviews for The Matrix Reloaded when it was released, obviously there was mass negativity around it. So it's not as good as the first one, but one of the reasons that they said that is they said the narrative is incoherent. They said it doesn't make sense as a film. They said, you're watching this character and then you just don't see that character ever again. They disappear for about 90 minutes. Or there's a particular subplot that's really interesting that seems to be going somewhere and then it stops and you never find out what happens. Or, as I mentioned earlier, you have characters that appear from nowhere and you don't know who they are and you don't know what they're doing now or what the point is. So in terms of that film, it seems quite jumbled and incoherent. So despite Evans's idea of what all of this does is make everything coherent, there's the sense if you only watch the film, or you only play the game, or you only read the comic, it actually doesn't make any sense. It only makes sense if you consume absolutely everything. So that means, films can suddenly become very problematic. Film critics don't understand their job anymore, because does that mean a film critic has to play the game in order to review a film? Of course not. So all of these kind of problems emerge. Does it mean that we assess the quality of a film in a different way because we have to be aware of what's going on the other platform? Should we have to consume all of this? Should the film stand on its own or not? Obviously, in terms of money as well, it costs an awful lot of money. It's bad enough spending $250 million to make a Batman film. It becomes even worse if you then have to have all of these games and social media sites and comic books and TV series, and then all of this has to be coordinated, so you have to know all the writers are, and you have to schedule meetings, and you have to schedule all of these connections, making it all incredibly coherent. And also in terms of audiences as well, kind of like the fatigue thing, it costs a hell of a lot of money. It's expensive to go to the cinema. It's even more expensive to go to the cinema and then go to the comic book shop and then download something from Netflix and then go and buy a game, for example. So there is all of these kind of potential provocations, mainly to do with cost, but I think also in terms of like the ideology of what a film is or what a TV show is or what a comic book is, it kind of means we can't really critique anything on its own anymore. Nothing can stand on its own 2 feet. It all has to be supported by something else that's supported by something else that's supported by something else. So in terms of a study, for example, does it make sense to do film studies anymore? Does it make sense to do TV studies anymore? Because it's not really how the industry's thinking. They're thinking film as part of television, which is part of a game, which is part of digital media. So thinking about it in isolation kind of becomes problematic. Okay, so just to wrap this up, 5 minutes early, this is kind of what I want you to have got out of today, okay? We haven't really gone into any depth, and that's very deliberate. We've not thought about wider contexts. We've started to think about different countries, but only with a very brief example. And that's something that we're going to do kind of much more of. What I wanted to do is just think about what transmedia is in a very simple sense, and what are the implications of that. So it's more about raising questions to that than anything else. The thing that it is absolutely, and this doesn't really change, it is about continuity. Okay, continuity is in lots of things. So continuity is in different industries being in continuous dialogue with one another. The film industry isn't a thing anymore. The film industry is part of the TV industry. It's part of the games industry. It's part of the digital industry. They're all connected in some way. They all talk to one another increasingly. It is the context, as we've seen, for transmedia. But it's also continuity in terms of keeping an audience engaged. So the idea is that the Matrix, you can keep consuming the Matrix for, I think it was more like 3 years, because of the fact that there was the sequels, but there was the games, and there was the web series, and so on and so forth. So in terms of story, it was constantly being out there. It didn't die away. So there's a continuity there in terms of keeping an audience. But continuity in terms of story as well, you know, inviting audiences to move across lots of different platforms. It's about coherence, whether that maybe can be disputed, maybe films be kind of become incoherent, as I said. But the idea that somehow, and this is a big sort of idea that academics say, somehow as a media landscape, it's more coherent than it's ever been. Okay, it's not so much about thinking about different audiences and different demographics and different genres and different types of films and different platforms. Somehow they're all converged, somehow they're all connected, somehow they're all part of the same type of experience, media consumption. It's kind of one of the reasons why this word content tends to be talked about more and more these days. People don't really distinguish between, say, a film and television. If it's on Netflix, for example, it's just content. It's just a video. It's just something else that's online. In the same way that a video on Facebook is just content. It's something else online. As soon as it becomes digital, as soon as it becomes transmedia, there's this sense of the divisions between platforms, the divisions between stories, the divisions between genres kind of evaporating, and that obviously raises really interesting questions. And depth. The idea is the reason why transmedia seems really, really cool is it brings depth. It allows you to learn more. It can have an educational function. You can delve into the histories of characters. You can learn about the sequels and what happened next. You can learn about the wider story world. You can go and play games. You can learn. You can read fake newspapers from Gotham City, for example. So as a media experience, the idea is we can do more. We can learn more. There is an added depth. Obviously, this is sort of a key kind of distinction. When people talk about transmedia, the idea of story is kind of irrelevant now. It's story world, right? It's stories becoming story worlds. So it's not so much, I'm just going to get this right, actually. There's a quote from a Hollywood producer, if I can get this right, who says it used to be that you would pitch a story to a studio. A script. You would write a script about a particular story and then they would decide whether or not to make it. That was like 40, 50 years ago. Then by the time you get to like 70s, 80s, he said, well, actually, when you were pitching scripts, you wouldn't pitch a story, you'd pitch a character. Reason being, if you pitch a character can tell multiple stories. So if they go with your character, they can make a sequel and they like that because it can make more money. Now, it's not even that. It's not even you pitch a story or you pitch a character. Now you pitch a world. Okay, this is what producers are saying. You go in and you pitch the idea of a world, because if you pitch a world, that world can sustain multiple characters, but it can also sustain multiple stories. Okay, you can keep doing more and more and add more and more depth, more and more coherence, more and more continuity. So industry now, particularly film, is thinking about the worlds that stories exist within. Audiences, as we've seen, you can become a gatherer, you can become a hunter, you can learn more and more, you can become active. Lecture 5 is particularly going to be about this idea of participatory audiences and how we engage with transmedia stories. And I think on a very basic level, these ideas from Kinder do sort of underpin transmedia. I think we can expand upon them. But the basic idea, as on a text, it has to be driven by intertextuality, constantly referring to different types of things, different types of stories. Again, films not standing on their own, which makes this idea of collectability. You want to buy the next thing. You have to buy, if a film refers to a game, you have to then go and buy the game. Which means all of those things are, of course, cross-promotional. Making more money, encouraging audiences to buy more and more. And in that sense, again, it was sort of the key point, but transmedia is about engaging wider audiences. That is the sort of the baseline, okay? Tomorrow, yes, I do have a slide. So tomorrow we're going to sort of pick up on this, go into a lot more depth, okay? So I've kind of done some research, really trying to understand the characteristics of transmedia. So we're going to sort of look at that. We're going to think, actually, what are these sort of different characteristics and how do they evolve? How do they change? What are the implications? And picking up on today, also other kind of underpinning ideas like promotion and brand. And then in the third one, because there's two tomorrow, we're going to go back in time. How did transmedia emerge historically? What could have happened 100 years ago that enabled you to tell a story across media platforms in a way that, say, Henry Jenkins says can't happen without convergence? So that's tomorrow, okay? I'm going to leave it there. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You got an applause.
Usually.
I did.
Usually.